tightly, with a tight hand grip. This is indicative of discomfort. Remember, it is by gauging changes from baseline postures that we can note when uneasiness arises. Watch to see if the person opens up ventrally as they become more relaxed. I find that when I give lectures, many of the participants initially will sit with their arms crossed and then loosen them over time. Obviously, something happens to elicit this behavior. Probably greater comfort with their surroundings and their instructor. It could be argued that women or men cross their arms simply because they are cold. But this does not negate the nonverbal meaning, since cold is a form of discomfort. People who are uncomfortable while being interviewed, that is, suspects in criminal investigations, children in trouble with their parents, or an employee being questioned for improper conduct, often complain of feeling cold during the interview. Regardless of the reason, when we are distressed, the limbic brain engages various systems of the body in preparation for the freeze, flight, or fight survival response. One of the effects is that blood is channeled through the large muscles of the limbs and away from the skin, in case those muscles will need to be used to escape or combat the threat. As blood is diverted to these vital areas, some people lose their normal skin tone and will actually look pale or as if they are in shock. Since blood is the main source of our body warmth, diverting blood away from the skin and into deeper muscles makes the body's surface feel cooler. For example, in the interview mentioned earlier in which the young man clutched the pillow, he complained of being cold the whole time we were there, even though I turned the air conditioner off. Both his father and I were fine. He was the only one complaining about the temperature. Why you can't stomach certain topics. Did you ever wonder why you get an upset stomach if there is an argument at the dinner table? When you are upset, your digestive system no longer has as much blood as it needs for proper digestion. Just as your limbic system's freeze, flight, or fight response shunts blood away from the skin, it likewise diverts blood from your digestive system, sending blood to your heart and limb muscles, especially the legs, to prepare for your escape. The upset stomach you feel is a symptom of that limbic arousal. The next time an argument ensues during a meal, you will recognize the limbic response of distress. A child whose parents fight at the dinner table really can't finish his meal. His limbic system has trumped alimentation and digestion to prepare them for escape and survival. Along these lines, it is interesting to note how many people vomit after experiencing a traumatic event. In essence, during emergencies, the body is saying that there is no time for digestion. The reaction is to lighten the load and prepare for escape or physical conflict. The torso bow. Bowing at the waist is performed almost universally as a sign of subservience, respect, or humility when feeling honored, such as with applause. Notice, for example, how the Japanese and, to a lesser extent in modern times, the Chinese bow out of respect and deference. We show that we are subservient or of lower status when we automatically assume a bowed or kowtow position, achieved principally by bending the torso. For Westerners, kowtowing does not come easily, especially when it is a conscious act. However, as we expand our horizons and interact with more and more people from various countries of the Near East and Far East, it behooves us to learn to bow our torsos slightly, particularly when meeting those who are elderly and have earned respect. This simple gesture of reverence will be recognized by those whose cultures show deference by such posture and will confer a social advantage upon those Westerners willing to demonstrate it. Incidentally, Eastern Europeans, especially older ones, still like to click their heels and bow slightly out of respect. Every time I see this, I think how charming it is that people still show graciousness and deference in today's world. Whether done consciously or subconsciously, the torso bow is a nonverbal gesture of regard for others. A supreme kowtow. The universality of torso bows was dramatically illustrated to me in an old newsreel of General Douglas MacArthur while he was assigned to the Philippine government before World War II broke out. It shows a U.S. Army officer exiting MacArthur's office after dropping off some documents. As he leaves, the officer kowtows on his way out, backing out of the room. No one asked him to do it. The behavior was automatically prompted by the officer's brain to let the higher status person know that his position was clear. It was a recognition that MacArthur was in charge. Gorillas, dogs, wolves, and other non-human animals also demonstrate this subservient posturing. Remarkably, the officer bowing out of the room was none other than the man who one day would become the supreme Allied commander of Europe, architect of the Normandy invasion, and our 34th president, Dwight David Eisenhower. Incidentally, years later, upon learning that Eisenhower was running for president, MacArthur commented that Eisenhower was the finest clerk he'd ever had. Torso embellishments. Because nonverbal communication also includes symbols, we have to give some attention to clothing and other accoutrements that are worn on the torso, including the body in general. It is said that clothing makes the man, and I would agree, at least in terms of appearances. Numerous studies have established that what we wear, whether a suit or casual clothes, even the colors of our outfits, a blue suit as opposed to a brown suit, will influence others. Clothing says a lot about us and can do a lot for us. In a sense, our torsos are billboards upon which we advertise our sentiments. During courtship, we dress up to enchant. While working, we dress for success. Similarly, the high school letter jacket, the police badge, and the military decoration are all worn on the torso as a way of calling attention to our achievements. If we want others to notice us, the torso is where it's at. When the president gives his State of the Union address before Congress, the red-garbed women you notice in a sea of blue and gray are those who, like birds displaying their plumage, are wearing vibrant colors to be noticed. Clothing can be very subdued, very sinister. Consider skinhead attire or a gothic look, or very flamboyant, such as that of musicians Liberace or Elton John, reflecting the mood and/or personality of the wearer. We alternatively can use torso adornments or bare parts of our torsos to attract others, to show off how muscular or fit we are, or to advertise where we fit in socially, economically, or occupationally. This may explain why so many people fret excessively about what to wear when attending a high-profile function or going on a date. Our personal adornments allow us to show our pedigree or our allegiance to a particular group, for example, wearing the colors of our favorite team. Clothing can be very descriptive, such as revealing when people are celebrating or mourning, if they are of high or low status, whether they conform to social norms or are part of a sect, that is, Hasidic Jew, Amish farmer, or Hare Krishna. In a way, we are what we wear. You are what you wear. Imagine this scenario. You are walking down a sparsely populated street one evening, and you hear someone coming up behind you. You can't see the person's face or hands clearly in the dark, but you can determine he is wearing a suit and a tie and carrying a briefcase. Now, imagine the same dark sidewalk, but this time, picture that all you can see behind you is the outline of a person wearing disheveled and baggy clothing, sagging pants, a tilted cap, a stained T-shirt, and tennis shoes that are worn and raggedy. In either case, you can't see the person well enough to discern any other details, and you are assuming it is a man, based simply on the clothing. But based on the attire alone, you will likely draw different conclusions about the potential threat each person poses to your safety. Even if the approaching pace of each man is the same, as the person nears, your limbic brain will activate, even though your reaction to these individuals will be based exclusively on your reaction to their clothing. Your assessment of the situation will either make you feel comfortable or uncomfortable, even potentially frightened. I am not going to tell you which person would make you feel more comfortable. That is for you to decide. But right or wrong, all other things being equal, it is their clothing that often greatly influences what we think of individuals. Although clothing itself cannot hurt us physically, it can affect us socially. Consider how judgmental and suspicious some Americans have become since September 11, 2001, when they see a person in clothing that reflects a Middle Eastern background. And furthermore, imagine how some Middle Eastern Americans have been made to feel as a result. I tell college students that life is not always fair, and that unfortunately, they will be judged by their attire. Therefore, they need to think carefully about their clothing choices and the messages they are sending to others. For years, people told me I dressed like an FBI agent, and they were right. I wore the standard agent uniform, navy blue suit, white shirt, burgundy tie, black shoes, and short hair. Obviously, because we have certain employment roles that require specific attire, and since we make conscious choices when it comes to clothing, we need to be careful in our assessment of what it signifies. After all, the guy standing outside your door dressed in a telephone repairman's uniform just might be a criminal who purchased or stole the outfit to gain access to your home. We aren't always who we appear to be. Clearly, we have to be careful when we assess a person on the basis of clothing only, as it can sometimes lead to the wrong conclusion. I was in London last year at a very nice hotel just 4 blocks from Buckingham Palace, where all of the staff, including the maids, wore Armani suits. If I had seen them on the train going to work, I could easily have been misled as to their relative social status. So remember, because it is culturally prescribed and easily manipulated, clothing is only part of the nonverbal picture. We assess clothing to determine whether it is sending a message, not to judge people based on their attire. Even with the caveats just mentioned, clothing needs to be considered in the overall scheme of nonverbal assessment. For that reason, it is important that we wear clothes that are congruent with the messages we want to send others, assuming we want to influence their behavior in a way that is positive or beneficial to us. When choosing your wardrobe and accessories, always remain cognizant of the message you are sending with your clothing and the meaning that others may perceive from your dress. Also consider that although you may deliberately want to use your attire to send a signal to one person or group of people at a specific time and place, you may have to pass a lot of other people who are not as receptive to your message along the way. At seminars, I frequently ask the question, "How many of you were dressed by your mother today?" Of course, everyone laughs, and no one raises his hand. Then I say, "Well then, you, all of you, chose to dress the way you did." That is when they all look around them and, perhaps for the first time, realize they could do a better job of dressing and presenting themselves. After all, before two people first meet, the only input each has to go on about the other is physical appearance and other nonverbal communications. Perhaps it's time to consider how you are being perceived. Preening. When we are physically and mentally well, we take care of our appearance, preening and grooming ourselves accordingly. Humans are not unique in this regard, as birds and mammals engage in like behaviors. When we are physically or mentally ill, on the other hand, the posture of the torso and shoulders, as well as our overall appearance, may signal our poor health. Many unfortunate homeless people are afflicted with schizophrenia, and rarely do they attend to their attire. Their clothes are soiled and grimy, and many of these individuals will even fight attempts by others to get them to bathe or wear clean clothing. The mentally depressed person will stoop as he walks or stands, the weight of the world seemingly bringing him down. The phenomenon of poor grooming during illness and sadness has been noted around the world by anthropologists, social workers, and healthcare providers. When the brain is saddened or we are ill, preening and presentation are among the first things to go. For example, patients recovering from surgery may walk down the hospital hallway with hair disheveled and in gowns with their backsides exposed, not caring about personal appearance. When you are really ill, you may lie around the house looking more unkempt than you ever would be normally. When a person is really sick or really traumatized, the brain has other priorities, and preening is simply not one of them. Therefore, within context, we can use an overall lack of personal hygiene and/or grooming to make assumptions about a person's state of mind or state of health. Torso splays. Splaying out on a couch or a chair is normally a sign of comfort. However, when there are serious issues to be discussed, splaying out is a territorial or dominance display, as in Figure 35. Teenagers in particular often will sit splayed out on a chair or bench as a nonverbal way of dominating their environment while being chastised by their parents. This splay behavior is disrespectful and shows indifference to those in authority. It is a territorial display that should not be encouraged or tolerated. If you have a child who does this every time he or she is in serious trouble, you need to neutralize this behavior immediately by asking your child to sit up, and if that fails, by nonverbally violating his or her space by sitting next to or standing closely behind him or her. In short order, your child will have a limbic response to your spatial invasion, which will cause him or her to sit up. If you allow your child to get away with torso splays during major disagreements, don't be surprised if he or she loses respect for you over time. And why not? By allowing such displays, you are basically saying, "It's okay to disrespect me." When these kids grow up, they may continue to splay out inappropriately in the workplace when they should be sitting up attentively. This is not conducive to longevity on the job, since it sends a strong negative nonverbal message of disrespect for authority. Puffing up the chest. Humans, like many other creatures, including some lizards, birds, dogs, and our fellow primates, puff up their chests when trying to establish territorial dominance. Watch two people who are angry with each other. They will puff out their chests just like silverback gorillas. Although it may seem almost comical when we see others do it, puffing of the chest should not be ignored, because observation has shown that when people are about to strike someone, their chests will puff out. You see this on the school grounds when kids are about to fight. It can also be seen among professional boxers as they goad each other verbally before a major fight, chest out, leaning into each other, proclaiming their certitude of winning. The great Muhammad Ali did this better than anyone during pre-fight events. Not only was he threatening, he was also funny, all part of the show, which made for good theater and, of course, ticket sales. Bearing the torso. Sometimes in street fights, people getting ready to strike out at an opponent will disrobe, removing an article of clothing, like a shirt or hat. Whether this is done simply to flex one's muscles, to protect the discarded clothing, or to rob the opponent of some type of hold he can use to his advantage, no one is sure. In any case, if you should get into an argument with someone and he or she takes off a hat, shirt, or other article of clothing, most likely, a fight is in the offing. One time you don't want the shirt off his back. Years ago, I witnessed two neighbors verbally sparring over a sprinkler system that had accidentally sprayed a freshly waxed vehicle. As things escalated, one of the neighbors started unbuttoning his shirt. It was then that I knew fists were going to fly. Sure enough, the shirt came off and the chest bumping began between them. This was a mere precursor to the punching which soon followed. It seemed incredible that grown men would fight over water spots on a car, What was really remarkable, however, was the chest bumping between the two guys as though they were gorillas. It was actually embarrassing to watch them engage in such a ludicrous torso display. It's just something that shouldn't happen. Breathing behavior and the torso. When a person is under stress, the chest may be seen to heave or expand and contract rapidly. When the limbic system is aroused and engaged for flight or fight, the body attempts to take in as much oxygen as possible, either by breathing more deeply or by panting. The stressed individual's chest is heaving because the limbic brain is saying, potential problem, step up oxygen consumption in case we suddenly have to escape or fight. When you see this type of nonverbal behavior in an otherwise healthy person, you should consider why he or she is so stressed. Shoulder shrugs. Full and slight shoulder shrugs can mean a lot in context. When the boss asks an employee, "Do you know anything about this customer's complaint?" and the employee answers no while giving a half shrug, chances are the speaker is not committed to what was just said. An honest and true response will cause both shoulders to rise sharply and equally. Expect people to give full, high shoulder shrugs when they confidently support what they are saying. There is nothing wrong with saying, "I don't know," while both shoulders rise up toward the ear. As discussed previously, this is a gravity-defying behavior that normally signifies the person is comfortable and confident with his or her actions. If you see a person's shoulders only partially rise, or if only one shoulder rises, chances are the individual is not limbically committed to what he or she is saying, and is probably being evasive or even deceptive. This is demonstrated in figures 36 and 37 of the PDF. Weak shoulder displays. Speaking of shoulders, be aware of the person who, while conversing or in reaction to a negative event, moves his or her body so the shoulders begin to slowly rise toward the ears in a manner that makes the neck seem to disappear, as shown in figure 38. The key action here is that the shoulders rise slowly. The person displaying this body language is basically trying to make his head disappear like a turtle. Such an individual is lacking confidence and is highly uncomfortable. I have seen this behavior in business meetings when the boss comes in and says, "Okay, I want to hear what everyone has been doing." As different people around the room proudly talk about their accomplishments, the marginal employees will seemingly sink lower and lower, their shoulders rising higher and higher in a subconscious attempt to hide their heads. This turtle-like behavior also shows up in families when the father says, "It really hurt my feelings to find that someone broke my reading lamp without telling me." As the father looks at each of his children, one will be looking down, shoulders rising toward the ears. You will also see these weak shoulder displays demonstrated by a losing football team as they walk back to the locker room, their shoulders seeming to swallow up their heads. One final comment on the torso and shoulders. There are a lot of books on nonverbal behavior that neglect to mention the torso and the shoulders. That is unfortunate, because a lot of valuable information comes to us from this portion of our physique. If you have neglected to observe this area of the body for nonverbal clues, I hope the material in this chapter has convinced you to expand your observational range to include the billboard of the body. Its reactions are particularly honest because, with so many of our vital organs housed there, the limbic brain takes great care to protect our torsos. 5. Knowledge within reach, nonverbals of the arms. In terms of observing body language, the arms are largely underappreciated. We typically place much more emphasis on the face and hands when seeking to read nonverbal behavior. In observing for signs of comfort, discomfort, confidence, or other displays of feeling, the arms serve well as emotive transmitters. Since the time our primate ancestors began to walk upright, human arms were free to be used in remarkable ways. Our arms are able to carry loads, cast blows, grasp objects, and lift us off the ground. They are streamlined, agile, and provide a formidable first response to any outside threat, especially when used in conjunction with the lower limbs. If someone throws an object at us, our arms rise to block it, instinctively and accurately. Our arms, like our feet and legs, are so reactive and so oriented to protect us that they will rise up to defend us, even when doing so is illogical or ill-advised. In my work in the FBI, I have seen individuals shot in the arm as they used their upper limbs in an attempt to defend themselves from handgun fire. The thinking brain would realize that an arm simply cannot stop a bullet, yet the limbic brain will cause our arms to lift and precisely block a projectile traveling at 900 feet per second. In forensic science, such injuries are known as defense wounds. Every time you bump your arm, especially if you run into something sharp, consider that it may have just protected your torso from a potentially lethal blow. Once, while holding an umbrella above my head during a Florida rainstorm, the sharp edge of my car door swung back on me and struck me in the side, breaking a rib that was left unprotected by my upraised arm. Since that time, I have a painful memory that reminds me to appreciate my arms and how they protect me. Because our arms, like our feet, are designed to assist with our survival, they can be counted upon to reveal true sentiments or intentions. Therefore, unlike the more variable and deceptive face, the upper limbs provide solid nonverbal cues that more accurately portray what we, and those around us, are thinking, feeling, or intending. In this chapter, we will examine the interpretation of some of the most common arm displays. Significant nonverbal behaviors involving the arms. Gravity-related arm movements. The degree to which we move our arms is a significant and accurate indicator of our attitudes and sentiments. These movements can range from subdued, restrained, and constricted, to exuberant, unrestrained, and expansive. When we are happy and content, our arms move freely, even joyfully. Watch children at play. Their arms move effortlessly while they interact. You will see them pointing, gesticulating, holding, lifting, hugging, and waving. When excited, we don't restrict our arm movements. In fact, our natural tendency is to defy gravity and raise our arms high above our heads. Get your hands in the air. You don't need a gun to get people to raise their hands above their heads. Make them happy, and they'll do it automatically. In fact, during a holdup is probably the only time individuals will simultaneously keep their hands high and be unhappy. Think of how athletes exchange high fives after a good play. Watch football fans raise their arms skyward after the hometown team scores a touchdown. Gravity-defying arm actions are a common response to joy and excitement. Whether in Brazil, Belize, Belgium, or Botswana, arm waving is a truly universal display of how elated we feel. When people are truly energized and happy, their arm motions defy gravity. As previously mentioned, gravity-defying behaviors are associated with positive feelings. When a person feels good or confident, he swings his arms affirmatively, such as while walking. It is the insecure person who subconsciously restrains his arms, seemingly unable to defy the weight of gravity. Candidly tell a colleague about a drastic and costly mistake she just made at work, and her shoulders and arms will sink down and droop. Ever have that sinking feeling? It's a limbic response to a negative event. Negative emotions bring us down physically. Not only are these limbic responses honest, but they happen in real time. We leap and thrust our arms in the air the moment the point is scored, or our shoulders and arms sink when a referee rules against us. These gravity-related behaviors communicate emotions accurately and at the precise moment we are affected. Further, these physical manifestations can be contagious, whether at a football stadium, a rock concert, or in a gathering of great friends. Arm withdrawal. When we are upset or fearful, we withdraw our arms. In fact, when we are injured, threatened, abused, or worried, our arms come straight to our sides, or they close across our chests. This is a survival tactic that helps protect the individual when a real or perceived danger is sensed. Take, for instance, the mother who is worried about her son while he is playing with rougher children. She will often cross her arms and fold them across her abdomen. She wants to intervene, but stands aside and restrains herself by holding her arms, hoping the play proceeds without injury. When two people are arguing, they may both engage in this arm withdrawal behavior, a very protective behavior of which neither party may be aware. This restraint has survival value. It protects the body while presenting a non-provocative position. In essence, they are holding themselves back, since extending the arms might be construed as an attempt to strike and injure the other party, causing a fight to ensue. Self-restraint can assist us not only in dealing with others, but also in dealing with ourselves when we need to be comforted. For instance, injuries or pain in the torso and arms often cause us to restrict arm movement in an attempt to self-soothe or pacify. We may withdraw the arms toward the painful body region. If you have ever experienced severe intestinal distress, your arms were most likely drawn to your abdomen for comfort. At moments like this, the arms don't move outward. The limbic system requires that they attend to our needs closer to home. Restriction of arm movement. Restriction of arm movements, arm freeze, particularly when it occurs in children, can sometimes have more sinister implications. In studying indicators of child abuse, it has been my experience that these children will restrict their arm movements in the presence of abusive parents or other predators. This makes perfect survival sense, since all animals, especially predators, orient toward movement. Instinctively, the abused child learns that the more he moves, the more likely he is to be noticed, and then potentially targeted by an abuser. So the child's limbic system instinctively self-regulates to make sure his arms do not attract attention. Arm freeze behavior can serve to warn caring adults, whether teachers, neighbors, relatives, or friends, that a child might be the victim of abuse. Guardians all. For exercise, I swim regularly at a local pool. Years ago, I became aware of a young girl who, while normally gregarious and outgoing, would restrain her arms whenever her mother was around. I noticed this response on several different days. In addition, I noted that the mother frequently spoke to this young girl using stern, caustic, and demeaning words. In the physical interactions I witnessed, she often handled her daughter roughly rather than lovingly, which was very unsettling, but not to the degree of being criminal. On the final day that I saw the girl, I noticed some bruises just above her elbows on the ventral side of her arms, the part of the arm that faces the torso when the arm is hanging normally at the side. At this point, I could no longer keep my suspicions to myself. I notified members of the pool staff that I suspected child abuse and asked them to please keep an eye on the little girl. An employee told me she was a special needs child and the bruises might be caused by her lack of coordination. I sensed that the gravity of my uneasiness wasn't registering, so I went to the director of the facility and expressed my concerns. I explained that defense wounds from falling do not manifest on the ventral side of the upper arms, but rather on the elbows or dorsal side, the outside of the arms. Also, I knew it was not coincidence that this child looked like an automaton every time her mother came near. I was relieved to learn that this matter was later referred to authorities, after others at the swim facility made the same observations. Let me make a very important point. If you are a parent, teacher, camp counselor, or school resource officer, and you see children severely change or restrain their arm behavior around their parents or other adults, at a minimum, it should arouse your interest and promote further observation. Cessation of arm movement is part of the limbic system's freeze response. To the abused child, this adaptive behavior can mean survival. Maybe I just can't get the FBI out of me, but when I see children at a playground, I can't help but glance at their arms to note any bruises or injuries. Sadly, there is so much child abuse in the world, and during my training, I was instructed to look for the signs of neglect and abuse in children and others. Not only as a result of my career in law enforcement, but also from my years as a father, I know what falling or bumping bruises look like and where they occur on the body. Bruises received through abuse are not the same. Their locations and appearance are different, and these differences can be detected by the trained eye. As previously stated, humans use their arms to defend themselves, a predictable limbic reaction. Because children use their arms to block their bodies as their primary means of defense, adults may use objects. A flailing arm is often the first thing an abusive parent will grab. Parents who aggressively seize children in this way will leave pressure marks on the ventral side, the inside, of the arms. Especially if the parent shakes the child in this position, the marks will be deeper in color, from greater pressure, and have the larger shape of the adult hand or the elongated shape of the thumb or fingers. While physicians and public safety officers routinely see marks such as this on young victims or patients, many of us are just not aware of their prevalence or significance. If we all learn to observe children carefully and look for the obvious signs of maltreatment, we can all help to protect innocent children. In saying this, I am not trying to make you paranoid or unreasonably suspicious, just aware. The more knowledgeable all caring adults are about the appearance of defense wounds and other abusive injuries in children, and the more we observe for such injuries, the safer our children will be. We want them to be happy and swing their arms with joy, not restrain them in fear. Restricted arm behavior is not limited to children. It can also be seen in adults for a variety of reasons. A friend of mine, who was a customs inspector in Yuma, Arizona, told me that one of the things he noticed at the border was how people carried their handbags and purses when they came into the country. A person who was worried about the contents of her handbag, whether because of their value or their illegality, tended to hold on to the bag tighter, especially as she neared the customs desk. Not only do important items tend to be better protected with the arms, but also those things we do not want noticed. Shoplifters tell. One of my earliest experiences with restrained arm behavior occurred more than 35 years ago at a bookstore where I was employed to spot shoplifters. From a lofty perch above the sales floor, I soon learned that these lawbreakers were relatively easy to spot. Once I understood the typical body language of shoplifters, I could identify them daily, surprisingly, even as they walked in the door. First, these individuals tended to look around a lot. Second, they tended to use fewer arm movements than regular shoppers. It was as though they were trying to make themselves smaller targets as they moved about the store. However, their lack of arm movements actually made them stand out more prominently and essentially allowed me to better focus on them as they went about their larcenous ways. Using arm cues to assess for mood or feelings. If you establish an adequate baseline by observing a specific individual's arm behaviors over a period of time, you can detect how he is feeling by his arm movements. For instance, arm movements can let you know how someone is feeling upon returning home from work. After a tough day, or when feeling dejected or sad, the arms will be low at the person's side, shoulders drooping. Armed with this understanding, you can comfort the person and help him or her recover from a hard day. In contrast, watch people being reunited after a long absence. They hold their open arms straight out. The meaning is clear. Come here, I want to hold you. This beautiful sight is reminiscent of when our own parents warmly reached out to us and we responded in kind. Our arms reach out, defying gravity, and opening up our entire body, because our feelings are so genuinely positive. What happens with our arm movements when we don't really feel positive emotions? Years ago, when my daughter was young, we were attending a family get-together, and as a relative approached me, rather than holding my arms straight out, they were only outstretched from the elbows, with my upper arms close at my sides. Interestingly, my daughter likewise adjusted her arms when this relative reached out to hug her. Subconsciously, I had transmitted that this person was welcome, but that I was not extremely excited to see her. My daughter responded in kind, later telling me that she did not like this relative either. Whether my daughter's feelings were original, or whether she had picked up on my sentiments toward this relative, we had both subconsciously demonstrated, with our less-than-stretched-out arms, how we really felt. Arm behaviors also help to communicate such everyday messages as, hello, so long, come here, I don't know, over there, down here, up there, stop, go back, get out of my sight, and I can't believe what just happened. Many of these gestures could be understood anywhere in the world, and often are employed to overcome language barriers. There are also numerous obscene gestures that involve the arms, some specific to a given culture, and others that are universally understood. Arm cues that isolate. Certain arm behaviors relay the message, don't come close to me, don't touch. For instance, watch some university professors, doctors, or lawyers as they walk down a hallway, or for that matter, look at the Queen of England or her husband, Prince Philip. When people place their arms behind their backs, first, they are saying, I am of higher status. Second, they are transmitting, please don't come near me. I am not to be touched. This behavior is often misunderstood as merely a pensive or thinking pose. But unless seen in someone studying a painting at a museum, for example, it is not. Putting the arms behind the back is a clear signal that means, don't get close, I don't want to make contact with you. This is shown in Figure 39 of the PDF. Adults can convey this message to each other and to children. Even pets are sensitive to segregating gestures of the arms. Imagine how isolating it must be for a child growing up in a household where each time he yearns to be held, his mother withdraws her arms behind her back. Such nonverbal messages, unfortunately, have lasting effects on a youngster, and all too often, like other forms of neglect and abuse, are later imitated and transmitted to the next generation. A pet peeve. Animal trainers tell me that dogs can't stand it when humans withdraw their gaze and their arms. In essence, our behavior is telling the dog, I will not touch you. If you own a dog, try this experiment. Stand in front of your pet with your outstretched arms and hands in front of you, but not touching him. Then withdraw your arms behind your back and watch what happens. I think you'll discover the dog will react negatively. Humans dislike it when we feel unworthy of being touched. When a couple walks together and one or the other's arms are behind the back, they are restraining themselves. Obviously, closeness or intimacy is not reflected by this behavior. Note how you feel when you extend your arm to shake someone's hand, and he does not respond. When we reach out for physical contact, and it is not reciprocated, we feel rejected and dejected. There is ample scientific research that suggests that touch is very important for the well-being of humans. Health, mood, mental development, and even longevity are said to be influenced by how much physical contact we have with others, and how often positive touching takes place. We have all read about studies where merely stroking a dog lowers a person's heart rate and serves as a calming agent. Perhaps this is true because pets are typically so unconditional in their affections that we never have to worry about reciprocation. As a species, we have learned to use touch as a barometer of how we feel. We reach toward the things we really like and hold unpleasant things at arm's length. If you hand someone a dirty diaper for disposal, notice how the immediate reaction is to grasp it with as few fingers as possible and hold the arm away from the body. No one receives training in this, yet we all do it, because the limbic brain limits contact with objects that are disagreeable, unhealthy, or dangerous to us. This arm distancing phenomenon occurs not only when we encounter objects we don't like, but also when we are around people we don't enjoy. Our arms will act as either barriers or blocking mechanisms, like a running back stiff-arming a would-be tackler, to protect and or distance us from threats or anything we deem negative in our environment. You can learn a lot about how a person feels about someone or something by noting whether the arm either engages or distances from the individual or object in question. Watch people at the airport or on a packed sidewalk and notice how they use their arms to protect themselves or to block others from getting too close as they make their way through the crowd. Then note how people with whom you interact greet you in social or business situations. I think you'll start to see that the saying, keeping someone at arm's length, has real meaning and practical consequences. Territorial displays of the arms. In addition to using our arms to protect us or keep people away, they can also be used to mark territory. In fact, as I am writing this paragraph, I am on an Air Canada flight to Calgary, and my very large seat neighbor and I have been jockeying for armrest territory nearly the entire flight. At the moment, I seem to be losing. I have a small corner of the armrest, but he dominates the rest, and therefore my whole left side. All I can do is lean toward the window. Eventually, I decided to give up trying to carve out any additional territory. So he won, and I lost. But at least I salvaged an example for this book from his territorial display. Incidents like this happen to all of us every day in elevators, doorways, or classrooms. In the end, if there is no accommodation or compromise, someone ends up being the loser, and no one likes to feel that way. You also see territorial displays in boardrooms or meeting rooms, where one person will spread his material about and use his elbows to dominate a considerable piece of the conference table at the expense of others. According to Edward Hall, territory, in essence, is power. Claiming territory can have very powerful and negative consequences, both short-lived and long-term, and the resulting battles can range from small to great. Territorial disputes encompass everything from a turf issue on a crowded subway to the war fought between Argentina and Britain over the Falkland Islands. Now, here I sit months after that flight to Calgary, and as I edit this chapter, I can still sense the discomfort I felt when my seatmate hogged the armrest. Clearly, territorial displays are significant to us, and our arms help assert our dominance to others with whom we overlap in space. Notice how confident or high-status individuals will claim more territory with their arms than less confident, lower-status persons. A dominant man, for example, may drape his arm around a chair to let everyone know that this is his domain, or, on a first date, might confidently throw an arm over a woman's shoulder, as though she were his property. Further, with regard to table manners, be aware that higher-status individuals will usually claim as much territory as possible immediately upon sitting down, spreading their arms or their objects, briefcase, purse, papers, on the table. If you are new to an organization, watch for those individuals who either use their personal material, notebooks, calendars, or their arms to claim a larger piece of real estate than most. Even at the conference table, Real estate is equated with power and status. So be observant for this nonverbal behavior and use it to assess an individual's real or perceived status. Alternatively, the person who sits at the conference table with his elbows against his waist and arms draped between his legs sends a message of weakness and low confidence. Arms akimbo. One territorial behavior used to assert dominance and project an image of authority is known as arms akimbo. This nonverbal behavior involves a person extending both arms out in a V pattern, with the hands placed, thumbs backward, on the hips. Watch police officers or military personnel in uniform when they are talking to each other. They almost always assume the arms akimbo posture. Although this is part of their authoritative training, it doesn't resonate well in the private sector. Military personnel leaving the service to enter the business world would be well advised to soften up that image, so they don't come across so authoritatively. To see an example of the arms akimbo stance, look at figure 40 on the PDF. Minimizing arms akimbo can often ameliorate that military bearing that civilians often find disconcerting. The wrong arms of the law. People who question the power of nonverbals to affect the behaviors of others might want to consider what happens when police use the arms akimbo display at the wrong times. There are situations when using it can not only destroy police officers' effectiveness, but also endanger their lives. Subconsciously, arms akimbo is a powerful display of authority and dominance, as well as a claim to territory. During a domestic dispute, if a police officer performs this display, it tends to exacerbate the feelings of those in the house and may escalate the situation. This is particularly true if the officer exhibits this posture in a doorway, blocking the exit of the homeowners. Territorial displays, such as arms akimbo, arouse passions, since every man's home is his castle, and no king wants an outsider controlling his space. Another potentially dangerous situation relating to the use of the arms akimbo display involves young police officers who are taken off of their regular patrol duties to work undercover. When these undercover neophytes enter an establishment for the first time, such as a bar they are attempting to infiltrate, they may stand with arms akimbo. While this is something they are accustomed to doing, they have not earned the right to engage in such an authoritarian or territorial display among those they don't know. They advertise inadvertently that they are cops or the heat. Interviews with numerous criminals have revealed that this territorial arm display is one of the things they look for in trying to identify undercover officers. Except for those in authority, most civilians rarely stand with arms akimbo. I always remind training officers and supervisors to be aware of this and make sure that undercover officers are broken of this habit so they do not give away who they are and place their lives in peril. For women, arms akimbo may have particular utility. I have taught women executives that it is a powerful nonverbal display that they can employ when confronting males in the boardroom. It is an effective way for anyone, especially a woman, to demonstrate that she is standing her ground, confident, and unwilling to be bullied. Too often, young women enter the workplace and are bullied nonverbally by males who insist on talking to them with arms akimbo, in a show of territorial dominance, as shown in Figure 41. Aping this behavior, or using it first, can serve to level the playing field for women who may be reluctant to be assertive in other ways. Arms akimbo is a good way of saying that there are issues, things are not good, or I am standing my ground, in a territorial display. There is a variant to the traditional arms akimbo, which is usually performed with hands on hips, with thumbs facing toward the back, in which the hands are placed on the hips, but the thumbs face forward. Look at the difference between figures 41 and 42 on the PDF. It is often seen when people are inquisitive, yet concerned. They may approach a situation with this curious arms akimbo stance, thumbs forward, hands on hips, elbows out, to assess what is going on, and then rotate their hands to thumbs backwards to establish a more dominant stance of concern if necessary. Hooding effect. Another territorial display, similar to arms akimbo, can often be seen during business meetings and other seated social encounters when a person leans back and interlaces his hands behind his head, demonstrated in Figure 43. I spoke to a cultural anthropologist about this behavior, and we both concluded that it is reminiscent of the way in which a cobra hoods to alert other animals of his dominance and power. This hooding effect makes us larger than life and tells others, I am in charge here. There is also a pecking order to this and other dominance displays. For instance, while waiting for a meeting to begin, the office supervisor may assume the interlaced hands behind the head, elbows out display. However, when the boss comes into the room, this territorial hooding display will stop. Claiming territory is for those of high status or those in charge. Thus, it is the boss's right to assume this behavior, while everyone else will be expected to bring their hands down to the table in an appropriate show of deference. Dominant pose. Often, individuals will use their arms to simultaneously emphasize a point and claim territory. This happens frequently during interactions where people are in disagreement over an issue. I recall a recent incident during a layover in New York, wherein a hotel guest approached the front desk with his arms close to his body and asked the clerk on duty for a favor. When the favor was rejected, the guest shifted his request to a demand, and his arms shifted as well, spreading farther and farther apart, claiming more and more territory as the conversation became increasingly heated. This arm-spread behavior is a powerful limbic response employed to establish dominance and emphasize a person's point of view. See Figure 44 of the PDF. As a general rule, the meek will pull in their arms. The strong, powerful, or indignant will spread them out to claim more territory. Spreading arms should spread alarms. Several years ago, I was involved in training American Airlines security personnel overseas. One of the employees pointed out to me that ticket agents can often identify passengers who will become problematic by how wide they position their arms when they are at the counter. From that day forward, I have looked for this behavior and have witnessed it countless times during confrontations. I was at the airport, yes, once again, when I overheard a passenger being told of a new regulation that required him to pay a surcharge for his overweight luggage. Immediately, as if on cue, this man splayed his arms so far apart on the counter that it actually forced him to bend at the waist. During the argument that ensued, the airline employee stepped back and crossed his arms in front of his chest and informed the passenger that unless he cooperated and calmed down, he wouldn't be allowed on the airplane. Incidentally, it's not every day one gets to see two remarkable arm behaviors all at once in what became an arm wrestling match at a distance. In business meetings, a speaker who takes and maintains a large territorial footprint is likely very confident about what is being discussed. Look at Figure 45 for an example. Spread out arms is one of those nonverbals with high accuracy because it is limbic in origin and proclaims, I am confident. Conversely, note how quickly someone who is splayed out over several chairs will withdraw his arms when questioned about something that makes him feel uncomfortable. The SWAT commander who put down his arms. Years ago, I was involved in planning a SWAT operation that was to take place in Lakeland, Florida. As the mission planner was describing the operation order, he seemed to have everything covered. His arms were outstretched over two chairs as he confidently went through the very detailed arrest plan. Suddenly someone asked, "What about the Lakeland paramedics? Have they been contacted?" Instantly, the mission planner withdrew his arms and dropped them between his knees, palms together. This was a significant change in territorial behavior. He went from dominating a large space to being as narrow as possible, all because he had not made the